You are listening to Chaos on the Set, a chaotic TV and film review podcast. You have two of your usual crew back with you today. I'm Shruti.
And I'm Mike.
And we also have a special guest joining us today on her very last day in Los Angeles. She decided to record a podcast about a movie where people are flying to Los Angeles. Shreya, thank you for joining us again.
Happy to be here.
Of course, this won't be your last podcast appearance, but you know, I just want to highlight the fact that you're leaving LA. She's leaving me. We decided this week to cover Christopher Nolan's Inception in honor of Oppenheimer coming out during the famous Barbenheimer weekend. And we'll definitely be talking more about that towards the end of the podcast. But right off the bat, I found out last week that Mike has never seen Inception. So I truly cannot wait to hear. Mike, what did you think of this movie?
Yeah, so first, before I get into my actual thoughts, I just want to sort of preface that I always, you know, felt that from based on what I've heard, based on, you know, what people have seen in the regard that this film is typically held in, I always viewed Inception as sort of like Nolan's biggest film, right? His most popular film in a sort of sense, probably right up there with Interstellar, but Interstellar I saw years ago. So for me, like, Inception was the big one that I hadn't seen. And then when I started watching some other Nolan films, some lesser known films, such as like Insomnia, or going back to Memento, you know, I sort of started to think, why don't I just save this to the end? Like, I'll get through all of his other films and then I'll do Inception. And the only one I haven't seen is his debut film Following. Maybe I'll probably watch it at some point, but like, this for me was like the big one that I was sort of sitting on for a while. And anytime I told people I hadn't seen it, they were always shocked by it. But I watched it for the first time earlier this week, and then I actually rewatched it again this morning.
I was going to say that, like, Mike, I think you do need to rewatch this
movie before
we record, or else the podcast would just probably get way too like, you would just be, half the podcast would be us reminding you about little details in this movie.
Yeah, and honestly, like, I'm ready to rewatch it again. Like, I'm excited to rewatch it again. But yes, I watched it for the first time, and then I, like, was thinking, Jesus Christ, this is going to be difficult to talk about. So I purposefully decided to rewatch it at the most last second possible, so it is as fresh as possible in my mind. So I literally wrapped up watching it half an hour ago for the second time. Or at least I dreamt I did, to quote Michael Scott. But so I did very much enjoy it. For being a 2.5 hour film, I think it's very engaging.
And just in terms of the length, I do think this movie actually has to be 2.5 hours. Like, if it was any shorter, I would be like, I would be getting whiplash for how quick they have to go through all of the things that they do.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very fair statement. And I wouldn't class.
And I hate long movies.
I know. See, like, I usually don't have an issue with them, but I think they have to warrant their runtime, as does any film.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, I very much enjoyed it. I would say for me, it is probably like a middle of the road Nolan. It's certainly not my favorite. It's not Interstellar. It's not Dunkirk. But I would say it's in the top half for sure.
Why do you like Interstellar more than Inception?
For me,
see, for me, it's not even a question that Inception is better. But I wonder if it's just the order in watching it. And so, like, when I saw Interstellar, I had seen Inception already. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you had already had that, for lack of a better word, pardon my language, Christopher Nolan mindfuck, you know? And I feel like there's a certain number of Christopher Nolan mindfucks that can exist.
Sure.
Like, now Christopher Nolan isn't even really doing that. Now he's doing historical dramas.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we did the Interstellar podcast, which was quite a while ago. I think you maybe picked out some flaws with it. For me, it's like a perfect film, and that's like, it was probably like the first Nolan experience besides The Dark Knight, like the first Nolan mindfuck experience that I had. And I, you know, as like a teenager, and probably watched it 10 times after that, I just love it. And I think in general, I'm more fascinated by space as a genre is mm-hmm. typically, there's a lot of space sci-fi films that I really love. 2001, A Space Odyssey being a prime example of that, but certainly many others. So I think that helps. Also, I feel like, although clearly there is that familial emotional aspect to this film between Leonardo DiCaprio and Marion Cotillard and his children.
Is there though?
There is. We'll I mean, there. We'll right. There's that. There is yeah. that sense of drama. I for me. I will, yeah, for me,
Interstellar
it's,
definitely has a stronger emotional connection between yeah. Murph and yes. her father than Leo and Aww. His dead wife.
Yeah. So I think for those reasons I'm a bit more attracted to Interstellar. That being said, my first experience watching Inception was very interesting. I don't know if you read my review on Letterboxd, but I literally...
No, I didn't even realize you logged it.
I logged it twice. But
okay,
the,
well, one of them was this morning, so...
Yes, yeah. The second one is just the Michael Scott joke. But my first experience watching it, I got to the very end of the film, like, last 5 minutes... Right as the meeting with Saito begins, as him as an old man, and my power went out, like into the entire house, the power went out, and because I have a Roku TV, it's connected to the Wi-Fi. Like, in order to get the TV up and running again after the Wi-Fi goes out, it's like a 15-minute process. Like, it's not fast.
That's so annoying.
Yeah, and I'd watched this film at, like, I was wrapping it up at, like, midnight. So I just decided to, like, go on my phone and, like, find just a YouTube clip of the ending of the film, and that's how I watched it. But literally, when the power...
Were you, like, not sure if the end of the YouTube video was the actual end of the movie, and you were like, maybe I just need to find a long
I had
video
to find
with
a,
the cop...
I had to find a couple different ones to make sure I was getting the full picture.
This is so devastating to me that this is how you
But
ended
it when the power went out, when the power went out, I was like, is this my fall? Like, is this it? Like, trying to snap me back into reality? So that was certainly... it was a fun anecdote of my my viewing experience, but I did thoroughly enjoy it, for sure.
Quick aside, I used to have terrible Wi-Fi when I first moved into my last house, and I was trying to watch what is that Anthony Hopkins Olivia Colman movie about dementia?
The Father. Oh, masterpiece.
It's so good, but I was watching The Father and it kept buffering at the very end when Anthony Hopkins is like breaking down, and I had to just like keep pausing in this emotional turmoil waiting for it to difficult. Load. It was truly the most devastating watch experience I've ever had. It was so awful. Such a good movie, but I was like, this is so painful for me to watch. Yeah, Wi-Fi will screw your movie watching experiences. Shreya, our Wi-Fi was fine while we watched Inception. What did you think of our rewatch?
I know, new. We usually have so many Wi-Fi problems. I remember the first time watching this movie, absolutely loving it. And I know growing up, we were big fans of Christopher Nolan. And I think that has changed a lot since just the dialogue around Christopher Nolan has changed. And I think that is the biggest thing holding me back from really loving this movie, just because his inability to write women is so glaring. And it really comes through in this movie where Dom says, I can't even outline all of the different shades of you to his wife, and it's just so apparently clear that Christopher Nolan is obsessed with killing off wives, and that's so frustrating. And I think that frustration leaks in to this movie a lot, where I find myself getting annoyed at times, but at its core I think it's a really interesting and fun movie, and I think that Christopher Nolan is really good at exploring a fun concept and theorizing about it a lot. And this is the ultimate movie for that, right up until the end where you don't see the top fall, but you see the top wobble. And it opens up to all these questions that you can ask. You know, throughout the movie, there's a lot of exposition, and there needs to be in order to explain a concept as intricate as Inception. And I don't think I necessarily mind, because I like watching Christopher Nolan for that, and I like thinking about all of these things, and that's very fun. But it definitely takes away a lot of the emotional drive, and I think leaves the viewer in to fill in that story aspect to it a lot, which is fine when you do it a couple of times. And I think my issue is that you do it all the time with Christopher Nolan, which leads me to be frustrated by this movie, but also enjoy it a lot simultaneously.
Yeah, I get that. I think before Shira and I like started watching Inception, or we were even just talking about like which Nolan movie we want to do, and there's so much commentary on like Nolan bros, you know, and just like how the conversation about the movie is bigger than the movie, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes it makes things fun. I love following conversation, but I've always been very frustrated by people saying like, oh, Inception makes no sense. Like this movie, like I remember in college, I had a screenwriting professor that was like, I'll give an A to anyone that can like make Inception make sense to me. And I was like, I can make Inception make sense to you. Like I didn't actually like go through it, but I was so frustrated that everyone was like, this movie actually makes no sense. And then when I rewatched it this time around, I was like, okay, there actually are a lot of plot holes. Like I can understand why people are like, you know, how come them jumping around in the van wasn't a kick? Like, I get that it is frustrating when the rules of the world don't line up, but for me, they line up enough and it makes enough sense for the world building to still be really fun and for the Christopher Nolan mindfuck to still work for me. You know what I mean? Like, it's still a very well-crafted story. It's all based in something that, like, when I was watching Inception for the first time, I was like, oh, yeah, when I do die in a dream, I tend to wake up. Or, oh, yeah, I never, like, know where how I ended up in this dream. Like, Christopher Nolan put these all in points of our own reality that we can identify with and built, like, I think a pretty complex and nuanced enough world that, like, even if all of the, you know, world building kick stuff doesn't fully make sense, it made enough sense to me, and I still enjoyed the watch.
I wholeheartedly agree that I do think there's a reading of the film that makes a lot of sense. It might not be perfect, and I think that's what's so great about this film, is that you can choose so many different interpretations on it, and probably with each viewing you could look at it in a different lens, and it might change your mindset on the film. But I would, like, the first time I watched it, like, I was not particularly too mindfucked, so to speak, right? Like, I mean, going into that final scene of the top, yeah, wobbling, like, I watched it and I was like, okay, Sopranos ending, right? Like, did it fall over? Or?
So going into it, you didn't know anything, no, that it was going to be like a cliffhanger ending. Oh,
no, I essentially knew people are like, oh, it's this crazy film that, you know, you have to watch it 7 times for it to understand what's going on. And there's so many, like, is it a dream? I knew it had to do with dreams, right? So essentially, and that ended, yeah, up being the final question, is he in reality or is he in a dream? And my thought was, if you choose to believe that the top wobbles and then falls over and he's living in reality, I think it's a very straightforward movie, honestly, like looking back at it. I think it's pretty straightforward. I think you can make it make sense. But also the great thing about the film is that you can choose to believe that he is in a dream or some amalgamation of that. There's so many different avenues that you can go down, and that's up to the viewer.
Mike, on your thought of whether he's dreaming or not, there's actually a great Den of Geek article that summarizes all of the theories, and we'll get into all of the theories, but it ends by saying that Nolan has often suggested that his comments about Inception over the years that are reality subjective, dream or no dream. It's a personal choice for Cobb. Either take the leap of faith by letting go of his guilt over the death of Mal, or become an old man filled with regret waiting to die alone, as he and Saito discuss. He need not be dreaming to choose the reality in which he lives. Likewise, Inception viewers should make their own choice about which reality they see this classic film in and embrace it as the only one that matters. So, on that note, let's figure out which reality we think Leo is in and whether or not it does matter. I mean, Mike, what do you think? Is he dreaming or not?
Oh,
sorry, I mean, to give you such a loaded question.
No, it is so difficult because, you know, like, is a lot of theorists point to, you know, like details that stick out to me are that the image of his kids never changes, right? Their clothes, their age, it never changes throughout this entire thing of what he's envisioning and then what is the supposed reality at the end. But I'm going to choose that it topples over. I'm going to choose that he's in reality.
I used to always think that he was in reality until this watch. My whole time I was like, if he wasn't a dream, I just didn't fully grasp who put him there, who wants to keep him down there, et cetera, et cetera. This watch around, I was like, wow, Dom Cobb, what terrible name, sucks. So everyone would probably just want to lock him into a dream.
It's just that he never escapes limbo. It's not like somebody puts him back into a dream.
Well, there is also, that's a potential that he never escapes limbo. But there's also a possibility that he does get off of the plane and then is put back into a dream.
Oh.
Just because, okay, so this is a... This is an on the theory.
Like, who do you think puts him into a dream? Michael Caine?
There's an interview with Michael Caine that resurfaced that the actor said that Nolan told him that whenever his character was in a scene, it took place in the real world. And therefore, Caine concluded that if I'm in it, it's the reality. If I'm not, it's a dream. Oh, wait, this goes against my whole thing. Unless Caine has now put... So Caine picks him up at the airport and then puts him in a dream for some reason. It all comes back to the question of, is Michael Caine and his wife okay with this man who basically killed their daughter going back and reuniting with their kids?
Well, then there's also the theory that Michael Caine hires Ariadne, Elliot Page's character, to figure out whether Dom actually killed his daughter or not. And it's not him giving Ariadne to Dom Cobb to use as an architect, but actually him plotting. And that's why Ariadne is asking Dom like all these questions throughout the entire movie and basically being his personal therapist. The theory is that Ariadne was hired by Michael Caine to figure out whether or not Dom Cobb actually murdered his daughter or not. I don't know about all these theories. I personally, there's, if we want to continue talking about theories, there's also the theory that Dom's totem was not the spinning top, but that his totem was his wedding ring. This adds to it because they say that your totem has to be entirely personal, and we know that the top was Maul's totem, so it wouldn't make complete sense for it to also be Dom's totem. And the theory is that instead his real totem is his wedding ring, and in scenes that he's wearing his wedding ring, he's dreaming. In scenes that he's not wearing his wedding ring, he's in reality. And you can see that in the scene with Ariadne where he puts Ariadne in a dream against her will without asking her and is like, how did we end up in this cafe? Dom is wearing his wedding ring, but then in the final scene, he's not, which would imply that it's reality.
Is he not, or is it obscured?
You see it when in the customs checkpoint.
Okay.
So like I guess hypothetically, if someone puts him into a dream after that, he could be dreaming. It's obscured in the final scene. I think the whole point of Christopher Nolan having this top wobble is just putting an exclamation point on this entire movie that is built to be discussed and theorized about and questioned. And I think the whole reason Christopher Nolan hasn't commented on it is because he doesn't want to end that conversation. Like, he thinks that conversation is the most interesting part. And I agree. I think it's really fun to discuss it.
I do like the Ariadne theory just because, again, it gives an explanation for why she's asking so many questions. Like, there's super cuts of Elliot Page just asking questions in this movie. Like, it just cuts to, and I think it's like half an hour of questions. So I like it as an explainer, and I just like it as a what a time to be alive statement that people are coming up with all of these, you know, funny little theories. Like, there's a, you know, theory about when Leo is being chased through Mombasa and somebody shouts like, you're not dreaming now, right? I listened to a podcast that like that guy has basically been like taken over by subconscious security, but he's real security, so now he's jealous of Leo because like this whole subconscious security industry has been created and this man does real world security. He's like, you're not dreaming now, huh?
Like, I just love that all of these, you know, there's so much to this movie that people can create all of these nuanced, fun, wild, wacky theories. But, I mean, there's also the overall conversation of, does it matter at the end of the day whether Cobb thinks he's dreaming or not? And I think that in and of itself is a whole different conversation. What do y'all think about that?
I personally think that the idea that it doesn't matter is incorrect. It obviously matters whether or not you're dreaming or you're in reality. It matters to you and the emotional connections you're able to build with other people as opposed to just your own subconscious. And it matters to your family if you're able to interact with them or you're just asleep. I think that the top wobbling is just trying to get more I think the top wobbling is to inspire more theories, and I think that's fun and that's okay. But I think saying that, oh, Christopher Nolan is trying to tell us that it doesn't matter, is, I think if Christopher Nolan was trying to tell us that it doesn't matter, Christopher Nolan needs to rethink his thinking, because it of course matters. And I think it doesn't matter isn't a very compelling message to send to your viewers after you just made us watch a 2.5-hour movie about something that hopefully does matter.
See, this is good, because I disagree. I don't think it, in the lens of this film, I don't think it matters, right? Because, and I'm going to try and piece together several trains of thought here, just like the film. So try and stick with me. And granted, I've only watched it twice, so if I speak out of turn, please forgive me. But I think when we, because it's interesting, Trey, you mentioned, you know, in the context of his family and the connections that he's making, that it very much does matter. But I think really the crux of this film is only centered on the figure of Dom Cobb and his own personal psyche. So to him, I don't think that it actually matters. And I'm going to start by reading this Christopher Nolan quote that he was giving at a college, I believe.
Was it Princeton University in 2015?
Yeah.
I knew it.
Yes. He says, I think, I don't know. It is Princeton University in
2015. He came to Princeton. Shre and I are from Princeton Junction, and Shre and I tried to sneak in, but we couldn't get in, and it was pouring rain that day.
I think we also went way too late.
And I don't know if we were even in the right area. But we tried to get in. What did he say, Mike? Why don't you enlighten us?
He said, in the great tradition of these speeches, generally someone says something along the lines of, chase your dreams. But I don't want to tell you that because I don't believe that. I want you to chase your reality. I feel that over time we started to view reality as the poor cousin to our dreams. In a sense, I want to make the case to you that our dreams, our virtual realities, these abstractions that we enjoy and surround ourselves with, they are subsets of reality. So I think if you apply that train of thought to Dom Cobb as a character, his reality, his dreams, his subsets of reality, they are becoming one sort of amalgamation. So to him personally, I don't particularly think it matters whether or not it is a dream or it is reality. And something that points to that is the fact that at the end of the film, right, he starts to spin the top, but he quickly moves on. He doesn't care if it actually falls over or not. He rushes to see his kids, leaving the totem behind. So at that point in time, he really no longer cares if it is reality or not, because he's just with his kids. And I think it all goes back to this theory of, like, if he is in a dream, I think he, a large portion of the film is the fact that he is processing his relationship with Maul and what he did and how he caused her to commit suicide through Inception. And throughout the entirety of the plot is him working through those. And he, I think in the end, finds that sense of closure and is able to move on from her, and is then able to move on to seeing his kids, whether in reality or in dream, and also probably having to now go down the path of seeking closure with what he has done to them as well, and working through that pain and grief.
Yeah, I think that that makes sense. There's actually even a line in the movie where I believe this is when they find, they first meet the chemist Yusuf, and Yusuf shows them a lot of people who are sleeping and come to be woken up in this particular part of Mombasa. And he says, "The dream has become their reality. Who are you to say otherwise?" And I think that quote stuck out to me because kind of what you were just saying, Mike, where these dreams have become so important to these people. So in that sense, I do understand what you're saying, that like dreams can become reality for people and can be really important. I just don't know if that's particularly healthy.
No, probably not. But he seems damaged enough. I don't think there's a path for him.
I don't know. Try therapy. Just a couple sessions.
Well, it's interesting to think that if John Cobb had gone to therapy, maybe he wouldn't have a murderous Mal character in his subconscious going and, like, ruining everything. And then they wouldn't need to, like, go to all these steps of, like, maybe falling into limbo forever. But that's besides the point. Or should we just get into that point? Should we talk about Nolan and women?
Yeah, sure.
Mal's character frustrated me so much more on this watch along because when you've watched Inception so many times, at least I forgot the way they unravel the plot, where first you realize that she has her declared sane by three different psychiatrists, like pulls apart this hotel room to make Leo look like an abusive husband, and then kills herself, saying that like the only way you can be with me, take this leap of faith, just like trust me and kill yourself. And so it paints her as this psychotic woman. And then I didn't realize until this watch along that you don't realize until later, no, Leo incepted her into thinking she was in a dream the whole time, i.e. basically gaslit her the whole time into thinking she was dreaming. And at no point did he ever think to just say, "Hey, honey, you think you're dreaming because I..." Like, just tell her that you incepted her. You know what I mean? And the way that they unravel the plot to not tell you, the audience, that they incepted her until the very end, so to make her look even more like a hysterical woman and just, like, you know, this woman that has absolutely no sense of her reality. Like, it's very clearly all Leo's fault, but they unravel the plot in a way to make you think that she's just hysterical and like, oh God, what did Leo get himself into? Women, right? Like, even Michael Caine doesn't care that his daughter died because, oh, you know, women be crazy. Like, why? Like, obviously Leo killed her, and it's crazy to me that not more people are upset about that. Anyway, I'm off my soapbox. What do you guys think?
I mean, obviously I think, right, it's played out the way that it is sort of to be another twist, another shock in the puzzle, right? In terms of withholding the fact that he incepted her. And I think really what it comes down to is that really not even this one thing, but pretty much everything that they are doing throughout this entire film seems to stem from some sort of ethical and moral gray area at the very least. And there's also a lot of questions to the actual bounds of what it is that they are doing within people's dreams. So, I mean, I think it's difficult to say that incepting her what wasn't the right move when they were in limbo for 50 years and were seemingly stuck there. But I do think you make a good point. I didn't even really think about it, is that maybe he should have admitted to incepting her when they were back into reality together. But also another part of me, like watching the film, I was like, One of my first thoughts, and it's probably completely off base, but after my first watch was like, is this whole thing, are we still in Maul's dream some way? Is it completely reversed? Did they even go back to reality like Leo suggested they did? I'm not even fully convinced of that.
Interesting. And so now this is her whole dream of torturing her husband who gaslit her into thinking that she was dreaming.
Perhaps.
And then killing herself.
Perhaps.
Although I guess that didn't really happen if it was all a dream. And now we're getting a little bit too complicated. But in general, I just think, I wonder, Shreya and I, when we were watching Inception, I asked her, do you think this movie or like Mal's character would work better if she wasn't a French woman? Like,
she is played very crazy.
Just also adds to the hysteria. Yeah. You know, like, she's just, when she first meets Ariadne and she,
oh my God.
And Ariadne is like, what are you doing here? I'm just like trying to figure out what's going on here. And she's like,
how could you understand? Do you know what it is to be a lover? To be half of a whole? No? I'll tell you a riddle. You're waiting for a train.
I'm like, what the fuck is going on here?
To be half of a whole. No, women are a full person. You're a full person on your own.
The way that it is written, it's very, like, it's hard to like her, you know?
Yeah, I think I'll say that I personally like the way the plot played out. I know that it leads us to believe that, like, Mal is this hysterical woman, and then later we find out that she actually had her subconscious incepted by her husband. But I think that the twist actually really works for me, and it works less when you're watching it on rewatch because you already know what's happening. And on rewatch, when you're so frustrated by Christopher Nolan killing off wives and depicting, like, this woman getting murdered brutally throughout the entire movie. And we know that, you know, Memento, The Dark Knight, The Prestige, Inception, he just keeps killing off wives, and you're frustrated by that. And I think that leads to some annoyance at how she's portrayed as so hysterical. But I think at its crux, like, if Christopher Nolan could write Woman more and didn't keep killing off wives, I think it is a fun way to play out and a fun twist to realize why Dom is the only one that's so confident that it's possible throughout. And his backstory makes a lot more sense and I think is interesting, and it is a fun twist. I think it's like other frustrations around this man and around Nolan Bros that seep in and lead to this frustration with the way this storyline was played out.
Well, especially if you're giving the read of this movie that Dom Cobb just needed to get over his grief over what he did to his wife and, like, it, now leave that behind, leave the spinning top behind, and then go to his children, like, that, yes, that's a valid read of the movie, but that read of the movie relies on you believing that Leo deserves to get over his quote-unquote grief over his wife. No, he did murder her. Like, he did gaslight her into, like, you know what I mean? Like,
I think murder's a strong word.
Okay, I will take back murder. But, like, if your wife is about to kill herself, why not just tell her you incepted her? You know what I mean? Like, he knows that this was a problem she was struggling with for a while, and he still did not choose to just come clean about one thing he did when she was literally suicidal. So frustrating.
Yeah. I guess I suppose the counter argument to that, right, is that when he does finally tell her, granted it's when, you know, they're in limbo towards the end of the movie, but when he does finally tell her that, like, he was the one that incepted her, right, and Ariadne is shocked and you know, Mal is taken aback by it, even when he does tell her, and maybe, you know, she would have a different reaction had she not been through all of this and through all that turmoil, but when he does tell her that he incepted her, her reaction is still a bit like, it doesn't matter.
Well,
right?
Let's just,
like,
be clear. He doesn't tell her. He tells himself. Because the person he's talking to is a projection of his own subconscious.
Which is even more insulting that this is how he looks at, this is how his subconscious depicts his dead wife, is this hysterical woman who is, like, constantly trying to murder people close to him. I mean, okay, let's get off of Mal. Ariadne character also very, very much frustrates me in this movie because she's truly only there to ask questions, and the thing that frustrated me most is when they're about to go, right, Saito comes in. He's like, Maurice Fisher just died. The funeral is in LA. Let's get on the plane. And Ariadne's like, I'm coming. So I guess originally in the plan, she wasn't supposed to go. And he's like, no. You can't come. It's not safe enough, little lady. And Ariadne says, okay, you don't need me to come, but the team needs somebody who understands what you're struggling with. So, like, you can tell Arthur about this or I'm coming along. Which just, again, puts this woman in this role of supporting this character, being there for his emotional journey. At the end of the day, she is there to forgive him and be like, get over killing your dead wife. Like, it's time to get over that grief. You know, she's literally there to ask questions, to support him, and then to forgive him at the end of the day. And that's just very frustrating to me.
Maybe because she was hired by Michael Caine.
It's possible. Although I do think at the end, right, like with her, I think that's a very apt and very fair criticism. But I kind of see her in like this Samwise Gamgee kind of role. Right, where like at
then
the very end,
Sean
like
Astin.
Where it like all depends on her, really, at the very end to kick off a sequence of events to make everything come to fruition. Like, it really, like, she saves the day when they're in limbo at the very end of the film.
That's
would
true.
Not have succeeded without her.
And Dom Cobb's,
but I do
them
think
all.
It's a fair criticism. Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, he's very Frodo-esque. He is taken by the ring. He is taken by his own subconscious. I mean, they really are the Fellowship of the Ring, if you think about it. Just the whole crew.
I guess in addition to asking questions and forgiveness, Ariadne is also there to be the writer of this movie. There's a big analogy about how Christopher Nolan's Inception is kind of a movie about making movies. He said, I didn't set out to make a movie about movies, but what I wanted was for the dream imagery to be resonant not just to me, but on some kind of shared level. And I think naturally, as a filmmaker, I just gravitate towards cinema as the collective memory we have of imagery and symbolism. And I do think Christopher Nolan's movies are best when he is making movies about movies. And so for people who aren't familiar with this analogy, basically, like, Dom Cobb is the director in this movie. I mean, he looks literally, Leo is styled like Christopher Nolan in almost a creepy level. He looks so much like Christopher Nolan. So Leo is obviously the director constructing the narrative. Arthur, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, is the producer. He's there to, like, support Cobb with what he needs and I guess do all of the research that he didn't do. Ariadne Elliot Page's character is the writer and the architect. Eames is the actor bringing the work to life, and then Saito is the financer or studio giving them all of these regulations and money. So I do like this analogy, and I just think it really works for Chris. When I think The Prestige is also kind of a movie about at least art and filmmaking, and Inception, the other Christopher Nolan movie that I'm a big fan of, is also just about, like, Christopher Nolan has all of these images in his mind and he wants to share them with the world. And it is an analogy for how he does share those stories. How do y'all feel about this whole movie set analogy?
I love it. I don't know, like, if what you've read. I basically read a review comparing the film to Federico Fellini's 8.5. Which is a...
Have not seen it.
Have you read the comparison between the two?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So Federico Fellini's 8.5 is an Italian film from the 60s. I believe, I don't know the exact year. But it is typically lauded as one of the best movies ever about making movies, where Marcello Mastroianni pretty much portrays Federico Fellini himself as the director, and that film is very, I mean, it's almost impossible to describe. It takes place also in like a dreamlike state, and it is difficult to sort of judge what is reality and what is not. But it honestly, like, unlocked a lot for me thinking of those two films in the same context. And I can't properly sit here and fully explain it, not having seen 8.5 for several years. But now I'm very interested in rewatching it. But something that really stuck out to me in what I was reading was the context of Maul and Fisher within this movie set analogy, right? I think you hit the nail on the head describing these other characters and how they fit in. But the way I read it described was that Maul is sort of his muse, his inspiration as a filmmaker, as a creator. And he's trying to get back to his kids, which sort of represent his original inspiration, his original sort of perfect vision. And then Fisher more so represents the audience, right? And as a creator, choosing, like, are you doing this for yourself? Are you doing this for your muse? Or are you doing this for the audience and how they will perceive your own creation? So I thought that was a fascinating read on it.
Yeah, I really like Fisher as the audience, especially because when you do see Fisher go into, you know, his father's hospital suite in the third layer of the dream and open the safe, and then he sees the pinwheel and he starts crying, and you're like, mission accomplished, right? Like, this story that director Dom Cobb has created led to the outcome that he wanted in his audience. So I like that analogy. I also like the joke that Dom Cobb is a director that, like, can never see his kids, which is why he's, like, never actually seeing his kids in the real world, which is probably true when you're flying all around to all these different... They filmed this movie all over the world, and I'm sure Christopher Nolan, if he has kids, never saw his kids during that shoot.
Yeah. I also really like this line where it says, take Saito, the studio executive who is willing to give Cobb a job, but just a job isn't enough. Saito must tempt Cobb with the promise of reaching his children, aka creative autonomy. How do I know you can deliver? Cobb asks. And Saito responds, you don't, but I can. That didn't mean much to me when the players were rival titans of industry. But when I saw Saito as a studio head extending the offer of creative control to the director of the movie I was watching, whoa.
Who wrote this?
This is by Maria Bustillos. And it is a commentary on another review by Devin Faraci, who compared the film to 8.5.
See, so many reviews on reviews.
I know. It's like Inception.
I love this. I love the conversation around this movie. More than the movie, probably. No, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. Ni le bien. As we said up top, we are deciding to cover this Christopher Nolan movie in honor of Christopher Nolan's next movie, Oppenheimer, opening in theaters on July 21st. And so I thought it'd be fun to do some midterm bets about Oppenheimer. Because we just talked about Christopher Nolan's treatment of women, I thought it would be a great bet off the bat. Do we think Oppenheimer will pass the Bechdel test? I mean, I know Emily Blunt is in it, and I know Florence Pugh is in it. I can't think of other female characters or actresses in the movie.
And I did not know all these people were in it.
You didn't know how stacked the cast of Oppenheimer is? All right, Shreya has the IMDb open. So just in case people are not aware. Cillian? Killian? How are we saying his name?
Killian.
That
Killian.
Killian Murphy, Emily Blunt, Matt Damon, Robert Downey Jr., Florence Pugh, Jack Quaid, Gary Oldman, Rami Malek, Kenneth Branagh, Josh Peck, all of these people are in this movie. It is going to be a stacked cast, but not many women. Do we think it's going to pass the Bechdel test?
Well, let me ask you this for reference. Do you know if other, like, what other Nolan films have or have not passed the Bechdel test?
So it's complicated. I don't know, but taking Inception is complicated because Mal is difficult to classify as a female character considering she is a projection of Dom's mind. Mm-hmm. Her and Ariadne do share a scene, but they're still talking about what it's like to be a lover slash basically being half of a woman. So I would say Inception definitely does not pass the Bechdel test, even if you do think Mal is a female character.
Mal kills Ariadne. Does a woman killing a woman count as passing the Bechdel test?
The Prestige definitely does not. Interstellar is, well, Anne Hathaway is the only female character, right? Unless she talks to
Murph.
I don't think Murph ever talks to Anne Hathaway, though.
Yeah.
And if they do, they talk about her dad. They definitely don't talk about science, which they could talk about. They could have a conversation about science. That's the thing. In Oppenheimer, two women could just be like, hey, do you think we should drop the atomic bomb? Yeah. No, I don't. There you go. You passed the Bechdel test. But I don't think it's going to happen. It's 3 hours long. It's a long time for two women to have. So in case you don't know, Bechdel test, you need two named characters, female characters, or characters of a marginalized identity to share a conversation where they do not talk about a man. It's surprisingly hard for some reason to do that.
I'll also guess that Oppenheimer doesn't pass the Bechdel test, just given the few number of female characters. I do want to say, like, the Bechdel test isn't, like, the through-and-through standard for being well-written towards women. Like, there's a lot of movies that don't pass the Bechdel test but aren't necessarily bad, right? Like, 12 Angry Men doesn't pass the Bechdel test. I think, so, and this
movie has...
Love
that film, by the way.
This movie has mostly male characters. It looks like Emily Blunt is playing Cillian Murphy's wife. So I don't know who Florence Pugh is, but maybe they don't have scenes together. And that doesn't mean that it's like a bad representation of women. I think what we're looking for is these people are like fully formed human beings, and hopefully none of them has to die to motivate a man.
Yeah, that would be great. I also, just because I remembered, The Dark Knight does pass the Bechdel test because Harvey Dent, I believe, either it's Harvey Dent or the Joker, one of them makes one of these female cops call their parents and say, everything's going to be okay. And so, held at gunpoint, she does pass the Bechdel test.
Yeah, I mean, I think the odds point to no, just with, like you said, the lack of female characters. But I guess to be a contrarian, I'll say yes. In my line of thinking is that maybe Christopher Nolan is becoming more and more aware of the criticisms of how he treats female characters. So maybe he will make it a point in the 3-hour runtime to try and rectify that. I don't know.
He didn't seem to want to do it in Tenet, but we'll see.
True.
3 hours. Oh, my God.
You can watch two Barbies and one Oppenheimer. On that note, what do we think is going to win the box office opening weekend, Barbie or Oppenheimer? I will start off by saying, so here's my logic. Again, you can watch two Barbies and one Oppenheimer. I believe Barbie is 1 hour 40, but I also have heard tells that Barbie is 1 hour 54, in which case you can't watch two Barbies and one Oppenheimer. But it's needless to say, you can fit more Barbie screenings in, therefore generating more money. Oppenheimer, however, will be on all of the IMAX screens, and it will be on all the IMAX screens for the next 3 weeks after opening. I mean, if you have not seen the Tom Cruise news about him being very pissed that Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 will only be in IMAX theaters for one weekend until Oppenheimer takes over.
After he saved the movies.
After he saved the movie theaters. Again, the 3 weeks thing doesn't matter. We're saying opening weekend, what is going to win? Even being on all the IMAX screens and IMAX generating more money, I still think Barbie is going to win the box office that weekend.
It's tough because I don't know what to expect from Barbie in terms of like a number, just because it's seems like so different and uncomparable to anything else. But putting it in the context of how other Nolan films have performed, Dunkirk did $50 million, Interstellar did like $82 million opening weekend. Tenet's really a throwaway, I think, because of COVID and that time in movie theaters. But of his recent films, I feel like they've had solid opening box office weekends. So I'm gonna venture an early projection of maybe $75 million for Oppenheimer. And I'm going to say it beats Barbie. I don't know if Barbie does 75. I'm going to say Oppenheimer 75, Barbie 50 to 60.
Damn, I didn't even ask for numbers. The mic is out here throwing around numbers. Well,
I'm really going to – I'm either going to be really, really impressive or look really stupid. I'm willing to take that back.
Inception was, by the way, a huge summer blockbuster, and people were – the way I've been reading a lot of and hearing a lot about Inception's development, right, because Warner Brothers basically gave Nolan all of this money, and it felt almost like a way of saying, like, here's all of this money to make your original dream movie. Now please make us a third Batman movie. And I guess their bet worked out because they got Nolan for those movies, and then they lost him for Oppenheimer. But they got Barbie coming up, and I think Warner Brothers is going to win that bet, but we'll see. Shrey?
I'll also bet Barbie. I think that a lot of people are really excited about Barbie, and I'm not saying people aren't excited about Oppenheimer, but I think it takes a lot more planning to have to go see a 3-hour movie, so just excitement alone won't push people to be able to be like, oh yeah, I have this much time in my day. And I think it being, like, you know, a dark black, like, partially black and white period piece will maybe take away from some of that excitement that propels people to then go buy tickets immediately. I think it's going to do really well, but maybe opening weekend I'll bet on Barbie.
And you have to keep in mind that Barbie is rated PG-13, Oppenheimer is rated R, so PG-13 movies just make more money.
I think why I shy away from choosing Barbie is because I've heard a lot of people this sort of sentiment of like, yeah, but like, what's it about? Like, what's the point? Why? What is this Barbie?
I'm sure you're hearing a lot of that.
I am, because I don't live in LA. No, because I don't live in a movie hub. But also, yeah.
No, but I think at this point we kind of know what it's about. I feel like that was the discourse when we like had a teaser trailer that was just 2001: The Space Odyssey spoofed. And wait, no, not sorry. What was the spoof of?
No, it's 2001.
Yeah.
When it was. It's just a spoof of 2001: A Space Odyssey. But now the trailer gives us enough to, like, ground us in knowing what this movie's about.
And also, I was there for it when we didn't know what the movie was about. I was like, give me all of these random set pieces of Ryan Gosling and Greta Gerwig, rollerblading and...
Margot Robbie.
Margot Robbie, what did I say?
Greta Gerwig.
Anyway, Mike, you also have some Oppenheimer long-term bets for us, right? Should we make those?
Yeah, I just wanted to put it in the context of the Oscars. You know, like, early predictions, just like throwing numbers out there. How many Oscars do we think it'll win? How many Oscars do we think it'll be nominated for? Do we set sort of an over-under on both of those numbers? To put it in context, if my research is correct, I believe the two most successful Oscar films that Nolan has ever made were Inception and The Dark Knight. Each of them was nominated 8 times. And I think The Dark Knight is also his most awarded, actually winning 4 out of those 8 Oscars.
The Dark Knight is also famously the movie that had the Academy raise their number of Best Picture nominees from 5 to 10, or 5 to up to 10 nominees, because people were outraged that it wasn't nominated for Best Picture, so they wanted to expand the types of movies that get nominated. And now we have up to 10 Best Picture nominee chaos. So thanks, Christopher Nolan, for that. I mean that genuinely. I love the 10 nominee chaos. I feel like that sounded sarcastic. And then Dunkirk did get nominated for Best Picture. So this is also a historical war movie. So I think it will get picture. I don't even know about director, man.
So I guess
it's such a tough
year. I mean, it's
year.
A tough year just with the slate of films.
Scorsese's going to get nominated.
For sure.
I can't think of names of other movies right now, but just hearing about how Cannes went down, I don't know that Nolan is going to get a director nominee, because we're also getting more international directors in the slot.
So I'm going to go... Maybe I'm setting my sights a little high here. I don't think Oppenheimer will win many Oscars because the competition in every category, you know, particularly, like, I think it'll be really fighting Mission Impossible for maybe a lot of technical awards, and then
And Dune Part 2 will also take a lot of technical awards.
Yeah, very true. Forgot that's this year. So I don't think it'll win many awards. It might win one or two tops. I don't think it wins more than two.
Yeah, I think the more interesting bet is what will it get nominated for. And also we get that answer sooner.
Although I think it gets an acting nomination.
Oh,
I think
interesting.
There's one in I think there's one in there in that
but
cast.
It's too stacked. Don't all of that cast cannibalize each other?
I think one gets in.
Emily Blunt.
I think
Emily
one gets
Blunt
in.
Portraying supporting wife of Bob Oppenheimer.
I'm just gonna say a bunch of random shit. I think Cillian Murphy gets nommed.
He does a great job in this movie in Inception. So
yeah, I think
I was telling Shreya, do you think Cillian Murphy will appear more stressed out and beat up after this 3-hour dream sequence, or after accidentally bombing the world? Well, not accidentally, intentionally.
I think bombing the world. I think potential supporting noms for either Matt Damon or Robert Downey Jr. I will go out on a limb. I do think Nolan gets a director nom, and I'm going to set the over-under for total nominations at 7.5.
Oh, God. And you're going to get the over?
And I'm going to say over. I think it ties The Dark Knight in Inception. Yes, Inception, sorry. And I think there's a possibility it is his most nominated film ever. I think it hits 9.
Wow. Okay. Can I take under 9 or do I have to take under 8? Because you're setting it at 7.5, or
I'm setting it at 7.5 with the caveat that.
But
it
you're
could.
Saying it.
I think it definitely ties his most ever, if not exceeds it.
Okay, I'll take the under. No logic, no commentary. Just.
I mean, 7.5 is a high bar.
Yeah, that's why I'm just like, you know what? I'll just take the under. I feel like that's with Dune Part 2 taking a lot. I mean, again, we're doing nominations, so it's not like they both can't get nominated. But I'm still gonna take the under.
I don't really know anything about the Oscars, but my twin sister knows a lot, so I'll also take the under.
No, don't follow me. I'm gonna lead you.
I mean, it's gonna be tough, right? Because you'd have to imagine that the most nominated film of the year would probably either be Dune Part 2 or Killers of the Flower Moon, right? And I feel like typically the most nominated film of the year usually nabs 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. So it could be tough to get another one or two films in there that also can reach 8, 9, or 10. But I don't know. I have a feeling about Oppenheimer. I really sense a lot of clamor and momentum.
Okay. Well, I'm excited about it. Do you think Barbie's
we'll
getting
see.
Anything?
I'll probably be dead wrong. Do I think Barbie's winning anything or being nominated?
Or nominated.
Oh, yeah.
I hope they get a screenplay.
Got to get
production design.
Got to
get
production design.
We say all of this having not seen either movie, but we'll see.
Could also see an I could see an acting nom. Also a great
That's
cast
true.
In Barbie.
Well, we will keep you posted on what we think about both Barbie and Oppenheimer and who is winning which bets after the July 21st weekend. In the meantime, Shreya, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Chaos on the Set. Would you like to tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Of course, I'm happy to join. You can find me on Letterboxd at Marate3.
Mike, where can folks find you?
You can find me on Letterboxd at MRicardi. And because Kate isn't here today, I will share that you can follow me. You can request to follow me on Twitter, and then I'll decide if you're worthy or not. At Mike_Riccardi.
Mike, I'm imagining you didn't listen to our 51st Dates episode we recorded without you.
No. I haven't seen that film.
Okay. Kate shared your Twitter.
Son of a... Okay. How rude.
You can follow me on Twitter at MicroMarate. You can follow me on Letterboxd at ShrutiMarate. And then you can follow our podcast. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd on all three at Chaos on the Set.